Today is Wednesday, August 17th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Coming your way, Russia again flies bombing raids into Syria from an air base in Iran. VOA's Jeff Seldon is here with a closer look. U.S. Republican presidential hopeful Donald Trump shakes up his campaign staff again. Jim Malone will be here to talk about that. And flooding has left thousands homeless in the U.S. state of Louisiana.
It's safe to say that the state in general is very accustomed to hurricanes, but this was a massive rain incident. And what we've learned is that in many, many areas, these were communities that have either never been flooded or they have to remember back 30-plus years to the type of flooding that they've experienced.
All of that and more on today's International Edition. Well, Russia's use of an Iranian base to launch airstrikes in Syria jolted the United States and its allies in the region, but the timing may have more to do with concerns about the fate of the Syrian regime than the need of Moscow or Tehran to send a message. The Russian Defense Ministry said Tuesday that its warplanes took off from Mohammadan Air Base in Iran to hit what the ministry said were the Islamic militant forces in Aleppo, as well as in Deir al-Zor and Idlib. Mark Toner, a spokesman for the U.S. State Department, yesterday expressed concern about Russia's increased involvement in the Syrian civil war.
It's unfortunate, but not surprising or unexpected. And I think it speaks to the continuation of a pattern that we've seen of Russia continuing to carry out airstrikes. And now it appears with Iran's direct assistance that at least purport to target ISIL and Daesh targets, as well as Nusra targets. But in fact, and we've seen this continually, predominantly target moderate Syrian opposition forces.
Russian forces have been conducting airstrikes supporting Syrian President Bashar al-Assad's government since late September of last year. Joining us on International Editions is VOA's national security correspondent Jeff Seldon. What's this all mean, Jeff? What does this mean to the overall picture?
Well, according to U.S. intelligence officials, military officials, others who have been watching this closely for some time, it looks like both Russia and Iran, which at times have had differing views on how to handle the situation in Syria, Iran seemingly more supportive of the Assad regime, specifically Russia more intent on keeping a foothold, a base in the Middle East, and whether that was the Assad regime with Assad or without it, they were sort of lukewarm at times. It seems that they've come together now and seen that, especially in the area around Aleppo, where rebel forces have made some gains against the regime forces, that there's a high degree of concern. So they're both, the big news that everybody's been talking about are these Russian airstrikes from Iran, signaling some solidarity, but tactically trying to give the regime forces in and around Aleppo some room to maneuver, to breathe, so that they can hold on to gains that they made. But at the same time, Iran is also doing quite a bit on the ground, sending in more Shia militia fighters. They had at one point more than 14,000 after a recruiting drive last year. It looks like they may be ramping that up again. So there is a high degree of concern. Of course, on the other side, this sends quite a clear message to the West about how the alignments are in the Middle East, what the landscape is with, and it sends a signal to other countries that perhaps may have some differences with Iran. You may have to consider that if you have differences with Iran, now you also have differences with Russia.
Are there any questions as to which side of what many are calling a proxy war here between the United States and Russia, which side Iran is on?
Well, there are always questions, and you got to remember, anything in the Middle East, conspiracy theories are the coin of the realm. If there's some way that you can have a theory that, you know, just like with theories that the United States created the Islamic State, not true, but there are a lot of people who believe it. Those types of theories carry quite a lot of weight. People believe them very readily. So there's always concern. There's also the understanding by intelligence officials, military officials, analysts, that while a lot of the world may be playing checkers when it comes to diplomatic strategy, military strategy, that Iran is playing three-dimensional chess, that they're operating on a different level with longer-term goals than most Western governments can imagine. And so there's always something to be taken into consideration there. Short-term, though, is both Russia and Iran have an interest in making sure the Assad regime stays in power, and they are taking action to make sure that happens.
But if you look at a map, these Russian planes are taking off from Iran and flying straight across Iraq. How does that fit in?
Well, there have been some conflicting reports on whether or not Russia had permission from Iraq to fly over its airspace. There have been some U.S. officials who have been quoted as saying they don't think the Russians got permission. There have also been reports from Iraqi officials saying that Russia was granted permission. One of the things to remember with Iraq is that there is a very close relationship that's developed between Iraq, Iraqi leadership, and Iranian leadership. And in fact, one of the big concerns for the United States in Iraq is the role that the Iranian-backed Shia militias have been playing in the campaign to oust the Islamic State from cities like Mosul.
It is a chess game, and you said 3D chess game, and that just describes it perfectly. Jeff Seldon, VOA's national security correspondent. Jeff, thanks, and we'll be following the story. Greatly appreciate it.
Anytime.
This is International Edition. We look into what is trending on social media on a daily basis on this here program, and we welcome a member of International Edition's social media team, G. Abby Lee. Gee, it's lovely to have you here. And
good to be here.
What's lighting up smartphone screens today? You said something about Ellen DeGeneres?
That is correct. You know, people cannot stop talking about Usain Bolt, the Olympic sprinter, and I'm not complaining because he's a legend. But today it's more about what TV host and comedian Ellen DeGeneres posted on social media. And that is, she posted a photo of herself riding on the back of the Olympic sprinter, and she captioned it, "This is how I'm running errands from now on." And that's controversial because Usain Bolt is Jamaican and Ellen DeGeneres is white. So some people found it to be a little racist.
A little too much, yeah.
A little too much, given America's history. And she responded to that criticism by tweeting, "I am highly aware of the racism that exists in our country."
Yeah, that's about all she can say, one would guess.
Really?
Then you had something about McDonald's.
That is correct.
What?
McDonald's says it will include fitness tracker with Happy Meal purchases and limited offer.
You mean one of those whole bands? Or
yeah,
just
that's
a, really?
No, the one that actually tracks your fitness.
Oh, okay.
And in six different colors.
Not the one that costs $300.
No, not those.
Okay, all right.
Not with Happy Meal purchase. And it's kind of interesting because McDonald's sells chicken nuggets and french fries and soda, which is not exactly clean eating. Maybe good for your mental health, but not for physical health. And an online publication focusing on consumer electronics called Engadget wrote a story on it. And so far, the new promotion is getting positive feedback.
That is G. Abby Lee, and she is following social media with us on International Edition. You can follow her at G. Abby Lee, and that's on Twitter, and
that's
probably
right.
On all our other platforms, right?
That is true, on Facebook, Twitter.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
G. Abby Lee with us. Among the top stories we're following, Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump again shook up the leadership of his campaign Wednesday, less than 3 months before Americans choose the next president. The second highest ranking official at North Korea's embassy in London has defected to South Korea, according to South Korean Unification Ministry. Russian warplanes flew from Iran to carry out airstrikes in Syria for a second day. And women's track and field events will occupy most of the Olympic primetime lineup Wednesday night, with medals being handed out in three high-profile events. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. And let's talk about U.S. politics now, and who better to do that with than VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, we just mentioned that headline that Donald Trump shook up the top leadership of his campaign today, less than 3 months before the election in November. Tell us more about this. He hired this guy, Stephen Bannon, a senior executive at Breitbart, which is a very conservative web news site.
I don't know a lot about him. Breitbart is pretty aggressive in terms of going after the Democrats, Hillary Clinton. Nothing new there. I think the conversation right now is, does this mean Trump is sort of doubling down on his controversial campaign style, which, by the way, he told a Milwaukee TV station just yesterday he will not. He's not going to change. Or with the addition of Kellyanne Conway, who's a respected Republican pollster and strategist, is it going to be a more disciplined approach that we thought the previous manager, Paul Manafort, had tried to instill? You know, at the end of the day, this campaign is about Donald Trump. And he's the only one who has the answers to these questions. And probably the management team around him is less important than what he decides to do himself.
Well, what is taking that into consideration, why do you think these latest changes were made?
A couple of things. Manafort's been in the news, not in a good way because of links with Ukraine and some questions about financial payments. But here's the bottom line. Take a look at where the polls are. Nationally, Clinton has an average of lead of 7 to 8 points. Even worse, if you look at the key, what we call battleground states, there's about a dozen of them that tend to go one way or the other in presidential elections. Clinton is pulling away to big margins in places like Florida, Virginia, even North Carolina, which last time went for Mitt Romney. So I think there's a lot of concern, not just among people in the Trump campaign, but among Republicans generally. It's one thing to lose the White House. It's another thing to lose their majorities in Congress. And if this continues, increasingly, they're going to focus on that.
Now, the Republican stalwarts, the people who have been in the Republican Party, their leaders, their congresspeople, their senators, explain to people around the world how they might be feeling about the Trump candidacy.
The fact is, if you look at the polls, if you look at the outcome of the political conventions last month, there are two parties. One is more united than the other. In our history, that usually spells good news for the party that's more united. Right now, I'd say some of the polls show about 80% of Republicans are ready to support Trump. It's more than 90% of Democrats supporting Clinton. He still has a problem uniting the Republican Party. That will continue until he's able to perhaps pivot into a more moderate way and try to reach out to voters beyond his conservative base. But he shows little inclination to do that right now.
And what about Hillary Clinton? She's had some problems of her own and the possibility of more. Is that correct?
It's always there. Look, if you look at Trump's drawbacks in the polls, temperament. About 6 in 10 don't think he has the right temperament. But the same holds true for Clinton and reliability, credibility. About 6 in 10 don't believe her, don't trust her. So that's a problem for her. But the point is, Trump's own misstatements and campaign gaffes in recent weeks have really propelled a Clinton surge in the polls. He's aided and abetted the depiction of him as somewhat unfit to be president. This is probably playing into the Clinton campaign hands at the moment, and they need to find a way to change that narrative. The best opportunity may not come till late September, when we're supposed to have the debates beginning September 26th.
Which would probably be quite okay with the Republican leadership, right?
Well, it may be. I mean, we'll have to see. They are looking very strongly in the next few weeks to see if he can turn it around, but he may be running out of time.
Jim Malone, VOA national correspondent, as always, thanks so much.
You bet.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in. Feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Here on International Edition, the story deals with the capital city of the southern state of Louisiana, Baton Rouge. 20,000 people have now been rescued from unprecedented flooding there, according to the governor. Most of those people, the rescues rather, were made by the National Guard and state authorities, but city residents with boats, trucks, and kayaks have taken it upon themselves to help out, according to the governor. Joining us now from Baton Rouge, Ms. Craig Cooper, a spokesman for the Red Cross. And Craig, what's the situation there now?
Ira, it's obviously a rapidly evolving situation. The good folks of Baton Rouge, they're certainly not strangers to this type of disaster. We have a situation now where we are getting the resources into Baton Rouge for us to transition into the types of outbound services, including the emergency response vehicles that most people are familiar with, where we'll be going out into the communities with food. Initially, the food that we'll be providing will be heater meals and things that don't need immediate preparation. But the good news is we have an amazing national partnership with the Southern Baptist Convention, and their mission is to bring incredible semi-trailer trucks that are mobile kitchens into areas where there have been disasters, and they are able to cook tens of thousands of meals a day, which they do the prep work for. They then hand the food off to the Red Cross, and we deliver it into the neighborhoods where it's needed.
Well, that leads right into the situation of community involvement. I mentioned that in the introduction to our talk here. It seems like a lot of people, neighborhood people, are helping one another. Is that correct?
And, you know, it's wonderful to see. It's very gratifying. Of course, the Red Cross is very proud of the partnerships that we have with other non-government organizations, as well as, you know, public agencies and things like that. But when it comes down to it, it's people helping people at every level. You know, being from Long Island, it was just 4 years ago that my community was hit by Superstorm Sandy. And it was humbling and absolutely heartwarming to see the outreach of neighbors helping neighbors. And, you know, truthfully, I'd like to say that it's the same everywhere in America. In places where communities are a bit more seasoned and they kind of know the drill, it's amazing to watch how the people down here in Baton Rouge have rallied to help each other. And equally, you know, gratifying to see how the Red Cross is bringing volunteers in from just about everywhere in the United States at this point to support the efforts.
Well, that is Craig Cooper of the American Red Cross reporting and talking with us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, which is saturated and flooded. Now we move on to music now. As the Olympics go on, the Olympics of the classical music world are wowing the crowds at Tanglewood with the Boston Symphony Orchestra's summer home in the Berkshire Mountains of Massachusetts. Jeff London joins us, talks about being selected as a BSO fellow is just as challenging as making the U.S. Olympic team.
This is a story about a young musician who learned if at first, second, third, or fourth you don't succeed, try harder.
I got close. I got alternate the past 4 years, but it finally took this fifth time.
Many audition, few are selected for the Boston Symphony's elite summer training program. When 25-year-old percussionist Miles Salerni got rejected the third time, he found a different way to get to Tanglewood. He joined the stage crew.
When I arrived, I was under the impression that I would just be moving chairs and percussion instruments and stands and maybe setting up some risers for the orchestra. I had no clue that I was going to be climbing, you know, 45 feet in the air trying to feed a rope through a pulley.
He got up on the catwalk and about halfway down completely froze and said, I don't think I can do this.
John Demick is the BSO's stage manager.
But he did, and you know what? I would hire him again today.
The musicians felt the same way, says percussionist Kyle Brightwell.
Miles kind of knew everything that was going on in the percussion section, and so we took advantage of that a little bit, and hey, Miles, can you grab us the tambourine? Hey, Miles, can you go grab us that Grover triangle clip that goes on the suspended cymbal stand? We could say that to him, and he would know what to look for.
And during those two seasons when Miles Salerni wasn't looking for Grover triangle clips, he listened and learned.
I most of the time went out into the audience during the rehearsals or the concerts and would try and just soak in as much as I could.
Fast forward to the summer of 2016. And the happy ending. After five tries, Salerni is finally a fellow. He got to play snare drum with his peers and the BSO on the 1812 overture.
It's very exposed and it was nerve-wracking, but very, very fun.
Miles Salerni's former boss, John Demick, says the stage crew misses him, but they're thrilled.
For us, it's incredible. I mean, once I found out that Miles actually made it through, I may have been the first person to call him to congratulate him.
And Salerni says,
I do miss the guys back at the stage crew, don't get me wrong, but yeah, there's something special about creating music, especially with a young group of enthusiastic musicians.
For VOA News, I'm Jeff London in Lenox, Massachusetts.
And cheering is also going on in Rio de Janeiro, where the Athletic Olympics are still underway. Women's track and field events are occupying most of the Olympic primetime lineup tonight, Wednesday night, with medals being handed out in three high-profile events. Reigning champion American Brittany Reese will kick things off at 8:15 when she defends her long jump title against teammate Tiana Bartoletta. You've been listening to International Edition. You can find us at voanews.com. Like us on Facebook now. Follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. Thanks for being with us. Thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, our engineer, Jonah Cummings. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
International observers and rights monitors have expressed grave concern over the reported mass execution earlier this month of some 24 Sunni Iranians. There are few details available about the individuals executed, but most, if not all, were ethnic Kurds and had been held at Gohardasht prison and were accused by the government of terrorist activity. They allegedly have been charged with the crime of enmity against God. There are reports that the prisoners had been tortured in order to elicit confessions and that their trials were unfair, short, and secret. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Zayd Raad al-Hussein said that the application of overly broad and vague criminal charges, coupled with a disdain for the rights of the accused to due process and a fair trial, have in these cases led to a grave injustice. Human Rights Watch said Iran's mass execution of prisoners on August 2nd is a shameful low point in its human rights record. With at least 230 executions since January 1st, Iran is yet again the regional leader in executions, but a laggard in implementing the so far illusory penal code reforms meant to bridge the gap with international standards. In its most recent report on human rights worldwide, the State Department said that in Iran there were severe restrictions of civil liberties, including the freedoms of expression, religion, and assembly, as well as abuse of due process. The report noted that the Iranian government disproportionately targeted minority groups, including Kurds, Arabs, Azeris, and Baluchis, for arbitrary arrest, prolonged detention, and physical abuse, and that the government's application of the death penalty disproportionately affected ethnic minorities. Regarding the reported mass execution of the Kurdish-Iranian prisoners, State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner said that the United States reaffirms our calls for Iran to respect and protect human rights and to ensure fair and transparent judicial proceedings in all cases. Mr. Toner noted that the United States has consistently expressed concern about Iran's human rights record through a range of channels, and that the United States would continue to highlight that record within the United Nations framework and elsewhere.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.